Listeners like you make living on Earth possible each week. Please contribute today by clicking on the donate link to the left of the page. And thanks.
Can I get a medium latte, please?
A latte at a coffee bar can cost $3 or $4, and almost none of that money gets back to the coffee grower. Indeed, a close look at coffee farmers the world over finds most of them get poverty-level prices for their crops. And many also run the risk of cancer and other health problems associated with farm chemicals. To change this dynamic, the Fair Trade Coffee Movement began. Fair Trade coffee merchants pay better prices by dealing directly with growers instead of middlemen, and by encouraging the production of premium organic coffee. Dean Sikon helped to build the Fair Trade Coffee Movement. He imports and sells coffee under his brand Dean's Beans, and has just written a book about his adventures in the coffee trade entitled Java Trekker: Dispatches from the World of Fair Trade Coffee. Dean, how did you become interested in coffee?
Actually, my interest is in social justice. I went to law school to become a social justice lawyer. I found out over a few years of practice that I wasn't very good at it. I didn't have the, pardon the pun, constitution for it. So I went looking for the right vehicle. And then one day I was giving a lecture about the causes of deforestation in Brazil. A professor came up to me afterwards and said, "I've got a friend who has a coffee shop in Providence. He knows that the farmers he buys from in Brazil are poor, and he'd like to do something about it. Would you talk to him?" We met, and we formed an organization called Coffee Kids, which was the first nonprofit development organization in coffee. And from that, after a number of years of doing that, I began to realize that the charitable approach was not about social change. It was a good thing, but it wasn't about change. Coffee companies would give us a small amount of money to do a project, and they would then get the pictures and tell everybody what great work they were doing in the world, but they wouldn't change the way they were doing business.
So what you're saying is that you would raise some money from coffee companies and you'd put in a well or a school or a clinic or something?
Exactly, which is great. But I thought, what would it look like if the companies paid the people enough so that they could make their own development decisions and pay for their own well if they wanted it? What would that look like?
Now, as I understand it, a coffee plant can maybe only use about 20 or 30% of a day's worth of sunlight, that if it's out in the sun all day long, it's not actually good for it.
Well, that's interesting. Coffee originates in forests. So when it was technified and turned into a monocrop in large open fields, it doesn't survive without the use of chemicals. But when coffee is grown in a shade-grown environment, which means it's interplanted with bananas, mangoes, avocados, a host of things that not only allow the plants to be cool during the day, which they need, but also provide food for the farmer's table and surplus for the farmer to sell in local markets. So it's a very healthy environment for the plant and for the farmer. In addition, most of the migratory species from the north, warblers, orioles, and a host of other birds, they nest in coffee forests throughout Latin and South America. And so when you denude the forest and build these monocrop plantations, you're destroying very critical migratory bird habitat.
So the world is changing in particular in terms of climate. What's the effect of global warming been on coffee around the world?
Well, you know, not too many people have looked into that, but in February I was in Colombia specifically to look at the impact of global warming on coffee. In this one area of Colombia, they believe that they are the elder brothers and their job is to hold the world together. So they're very, very sensitive to ecological change. What they taught me there is that as the world heats up, the upper mountains are drying up. So what that means is that the water from glacial melt doesn't make it down the mountain. That means that the nutrients in the soils on top of those mountains, the minerals, don't make it down. So the soil becomes less coherent down below. They told me that the bee populations are impacted. And as we all know, bees are essential for pollination. And if the bees aren't there, the flowers aren't there. If the flowers aren't there, the fruit isn't there. So there's this tropic cascade, this losing of species after species that these guys, the Arhuaco and Kogi people in Colombia, are desperate for us to understand that we're really messing up the world with global warming. And its impact is very clearly shown on the coffee they grow.
Now, you've traveled just about every place that people grow coffee. And one of the places I was surprised to hear this coffee from was Papua New Guinea.
Papua New Guinea is probably the most remote place in the world. When I was getting ready to go to Papua New Guinea, I couldn't find anybody who'd ever been there. And coffee was only introduced to Papua New Guinea about 60 years ago. They took the coffee in, had no problem growing it. Unfortunately, the farmers don't have access to information on how to process it well. Papua New Guinea is the only place in the world where people take handfuls of coffee, put them on river stones, and smash them to get the beans out, as opposed to processing them in machinery. And so it's very uneven. So that coffee can be one of the world's best, which would change the economics of Papua New Guinea tremendously if they only got a little technical help, which is one of the things we're doing there.
So tell me about your trip to Papua New Guinea. Of course, the people there, they have these masks made out of mud. They cover themselves. And,
yes.
And guys don't wear much more than, say, a little something around the middle.
Well, I was the first white guy to go up into these mountains since the Australian soldiers were there in World War II, which means that the overwhelming majority of the population, which is younger than World War II, had never met Caucasian, had never met an American, certainly, and had never met anybody who could say something to them about the quality and how they grow their coffee. So my visit set off a furor. I went to one village, and there were over 1,000 people in traditional dress. I mean, traditional dress is mostly what they wear, but I'm talking about boar tusks through their nose and 6-foot-tall bird of paradise feather headsets. The women were only wearing grass skirts and were covered with pig fat and ash, and they were in a mood to celebrate. The next place we went to, we were met by 8,000 people in tribal dress. And they were going ballistic. And so I got a chance to speak to them and work a lot. And they had celebrations showing how to grow coffee and beating the robbers who come and steal the coffee. There were morality plays. It was mind-blowing. I've never had an experience like it in my life.
So in Papua New Guinea, I think you kind of made a foolish mistake.
Well, I try to learn enough of the language, the indigenous languages, when I go someplace to show respect. And people really appreciate if I can say even a few words. So I learned how to start my speeches off in Tokpisin and how to close them. And the rest I gave in English, and that was translated. So in front of 8,000 people, I said, Apenun tru o merinaman blong Papua New Guinea, which means good afternoon, all men and women of Papua New Guinea. And then I gave my speech in English. And at the end, I ended with a flourish by saying, now my speech is finished. And I said, now mi tok tok pinis. And the guy next to me said, the translator said, and I looked and the crowd wasn't cheering. They were staring at me intently. And I said, he said, you just said, now I'm going to talk about my penis. And I said, I said, finished. And he said, no, that's penis. You pronounced it wrong. And I said, what do I do now? He said, well, you've got two choices. You can show them your penis because they've never seen a white man's penis. And a lot of people are very interested. Or you can close the talk. I said, maybe after dinner, I'm not quite ready to do that. So he told the crowd that I actually meant that the talk was finished. And I got a good round of applause, but there were a lot of disappointed looks in the crowd.
You have a story that you tell of a woman named Esperanza, which is hope in English. Not only did you change her life, she changed yours. I'm wondering if you could tell the story of hope.
Sure. I went to the Specialty Coffee Association International Trade Show. Happens every year. There are always small farmers from around the world coming there. They walk the convention centers with these little Ziploc bags full of their coffee, and they walk up to buyers and say, please, sir, would you try our coffee? Most people in the coffee industry say, oh, yes, I'm sure this will be fine, and then just leave it in their hotel room. Well, I met Esperanza and several of the folks from her co-op, and I said, you know, I only buy organics. And she said, well, we're certified organic. And I said, well, I only buy fair trade. And she said, well, we've been on the fair trade register for 3 years, but we've never had a sale. So I took that coffee, and I made a deal with a broker in California. Well, the farmers were ecstatic. And it was their first fair trade sale. I went to Peru shortly thereafter to celebrate it, and they showed me all the wonderful things they were doing and what they planned on doing with the fair trade money. Over the next 3 years, what's happened with that cooperative is it's gone from producing 3 containers of coffee to producing 14. The economic difference it's made in their community is staggering. they've taken the fair trade premiums, distributed much to the people, but also pooled it to create a women's loan fund so that women for the first time in history are getting access to credit. And I've got to tell you, the first woman took the loan to put her son in university, the first kid from this co-op to go to university. Other people have started stores and small businesses, and it's making, you know, an economic spinoff, a big difference. The indigenous group I worked with there, the Ashaninkas, used the money to create a reforestation program to reforest their sacred lands, which had been deforested in the 70s by illegal colonization. So, profound difference. Now, 3 years later, Esperanza, who when I first met her is a meek, quiet little woman from Latin America, now I take her to the New York State Teachers Union conference last year in Rochester. 3,500 school teachers and Hillary Clinton's the keynote speaker. Esperanza gets up and delivers an impassioned, educated, convincing talk about fair trade. The union votes to support fair trade coffee. Esperanza gets a standing ovation. The next speaker is Hillary Clinton. Makes a great speech and gets very polite applause. So that's what's happened to Esperanza in the last few years. She's become quite the international spokesperson for fair trade.
Dean Sikon's book is called Java Trekker, Dispatches from the World of Fair Trade Coffee. He's the founder and owner of Dean's Beans Organic Coffee. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you, Steve.
Ojalá que llueva café en el campo,
pa' que en Villa Vázquez oigan este canto.
Ojalá que llueva café en el campo,
ojalá que llueva, ojalá que llueva y no.
Ojalá que llueva.
Next time on Living on Earth, some states, including Colorado, are beating their targets for making clean electricity.
Our major utility, Xcel, needed to get 10% by 2015. And here we are 8 years early, and we're going to be meeting that standard.
So in Colorado, previously reluctant lawmakers went back and set the bar higher. And that state is not unique. Clean power comes on strong next week on Living on Earth.